Republican legislatures across the country, including here in Wisconsin, have introduced over 100 bills that would restrict health care for transgender children and adolescents, including puberty blockers and hormone replacement therapies.
Several states, including Arizona and Alabama, have passed bills into law that would criminalize certain medical treatments for transgender youth.
Medical organizations, including the American Academy of Pediatrics, have said these bills threaten the health and well-being of transgender children.
We're talking about legislation that would ban medical treatments for transgender youth, and we want to hear what you think at 800-642-1234. What do you think of these bans we're seeing around the country? Are you the parent or caregiver of a transgender child? What's your reaction to Wisconsin and other states introducing bills that would ban puberty blockers and hormone therapy? Would this kind of ban affect your life? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org.
Dr. Joshua Safer is the executive director of the Mount Sinai Center for Transgender Medicine and Surgery in New York. He's also senior faculty at the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai. Dr. Safer, welcome to Central Time.
Well, happy to be here.
Before we get into the particulars of the bills popping up around the country and the different kinds of treatments, can you talk about the impact on some transgender kids if they don't have access to age-appropriate treatments like these?
Well, the data that we have are for the period when we were not providing care, when we had statistics like 40% of children in these circumstances considering suicide, considering actual suicide attempts, and certainly self-harm.
I looked at guidelines from an endocrinologist association that you're a member of, and I think people sometimes think these kind of treatments are entered into kind of willy-nilly without a lot of thought. Almost every procedure there includes something like, you know, mental health counseling and evaluation before these procedures, these medications, and so forth can move forward. Can you talk about some of the barriers, the steps involved in a lot of these treatments?
I think the first thing that's important to consider when we're thinking about children is prior to puberty, we don't do anything with children other than support them in practical ways and listen to them and work with them. So if someone has a gender identity that's different than the sex that was recorded on the birth certificate than the rest of their biology, then we're talking about wearing certain clothes or wearing a certain haircut, things that are very reversible and where there's plenty of opportunity to think through plans. We follow that at puberty for children who are articulate enough to identify themselves soon enough for us to even act then with puberty blockers, which are, again, a very conservative intervention. It's reversible, essentially, that allows us to be thoughtful and for those kids and their families to interact with the necessary mental health professionals and be methodical and reasoned in their thought process. And really, that's about it for young people, for people who are under age 18, maybe towards later in teenage years, after we've followed these conservative processes, we might consider sex hormones that match gender identity. And there are some elements that are not completely reversible, but it's only after that very long process that I just reviewed.
And I think people, when they think of procedures, they might think of gender reassignment surgeries. If I'm reading guidelines correctly, that doesn't happen until age 18.
For the most part, that's correct. There, the two exceptions for what we would call gender-affirming surgeries would be in the case of chest masculinizing surgeries for the transgender boys, so female to male, where in someone where gender identity is clear, where all of the methodical process has happened, and where all are on board in a supportive way, a chest reconstruction surgery could happen at a younger age, maybe age 16. And then the other exception that's out there is with transgender young women who might want vaginoplasty en route to college, or some similar circumstance like that. Again, someone with gender identity well established, with a good conservative approach having been taken for an extended period of time. Sometimes it is convenient for the purposes of perhaps having the parents be the caretakers rather than having this person have a surgery and then go off to college. Depending upon when their birthday is, they might technically have that surgery a little bit before the age of 18. But those are the only two exceptions.
We're talking to Dr. Joshua Safer, Executive Director of the Mount Sinai Center for Transgender Medicine and Surgery in New York, looking at medical treatments for transgender youth, what is available, what's not available to them. As states around the country take action, bills introduced, executive actions taken by governors, limiting, in some cases, criminalizing these kind of procedures, you can join in with your thoughts, maybe your experiences at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Dr. Safer, looking at a state like Texas, now this is an executive action suggesting that parents who are seeking out this kind of gender-affirming care should be investigated for child abuse. What is your response to that move in that state? Currently, I believe, blocked by a judge.
I am baffled. I continue to be baffled by attempts to politicize what is medical care. The medical organizations involved are filled with thoughtful, conservative, science-informed people. And the idea that you would target anyone to deny them medical care, and that you would target parents to deny children care, or that you would target medical professionals in order to prevent them from caring for their patients, essentially violating their professional oath, is mysterious to me, to say the least.
I want to look more closely at some of the treatments you mentioned. Puberty blockers, as you said, reversible over time, but any medication is going to come with side effects. Can you weigh the costs and benefits of puberty blockers?
Puberty blockers for, you know, it's kind of an interesting thing in terms of who were envisioning getting these mm-hmm. puberty blockers. I think the anxiety for many is that there will be children who are not transgender, or maybe they are transgender, but they don't want treatment after all, who will be started on puberty blockers. And for that narrow crowd, the puberty blockers really are reversible. We've been using these medications for decades for children who enter puberty at an age that is early relative to their peers, and where we don't think it's the right time socially. And in those children who would have entered puberty early, where we use these medications, we later, when they are adults, we've been using these medications for decades, so we have adults who've had this experience, we later are not able to find health care concerns attributable to those medications. And so when we say reversible and that these are very safe, it's with enormous confidence.
And you talked about the process that a kid would go through to get these medications. How, before they're prescribed, how do you make sure, as a healthcare professional, how does the system make sure that they are informed, they're consenting, they know as best they can what they're getting into?
The typical process is for the youth, and the parents to go meet with mental health providers, right, for some sort of assessment that this is logical. And remember, these are very safe medications that are reversible. So I'm not too concerned about somebody using these medications for a short time who might be exploring gender identity and then opt out. That really, you know, when you talk about risks and benefits, you act like there are major risks. But when you have virtually no risk and then a significant upside benefit for trans kids, then it's actually an incredibly easy consideration.
Dr. Joshua Safer is with us, Executive Director of the Mount Sinai Center for Transgender Medicine and Surgery in New York, talking to us about bills in states around the country that would ban or limit medical treatment for transgender children and adolescents.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions or comments about gender-affirming treatment. And if you're a transgender adult, we would love to hear from you. How has transitioning changed your life? How would your life be different if you had been able to transition earlier? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email us at ideas@wpr.org.
The conversation continues coming up here on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Dean Kinetter.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we're picking up the conversation about bills banning health care for trans youth in states around the country. Dr. Joshua Safer stays with us, Executive Director of the Mount Sinai Center for Transgender Medicine and Surgery in New York. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your comments, your questions, maybe your own experiences. What do you think about this wave of laws limiting, banning, in some cases criminalizing gender-affirming care? Is this something that is affecting your own life? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Let's bring on a caller now. Angie is with us in Madison. Angie, hi.
Hi. I had a question about gender-affirming surgeries for cis kids or gender-affirming procedures. I'm thinking like breast augmentation or breast reduction, or in some cases I know that maybe children who aren't growing to the height that they want to be, and oftentimes this is like boys and young men receiving growth hormone. I'm just kind of curious like where the laws might fall on that and just kind of what your thoughts are on that.
Angie, thanks for the call. Dr. Safer, is there any overlap in those issues that Angie brought up?
I think those are great. That's a great question, and in a sense, great points. In general, we don't have laws with regard to healthcare. In general, that's the whole point for licensing physicians and other healthcare professionals in order to customize situations to the patient and not have some rule that, let's say, you have to use this insulin for diabetes and not that insulin, or whatever the circumstance might be. And so if we're talking about breast augmentation or breast reduction surgeries for a girl who is under 18, that's really a decision between that child and the parents and the physician. And with gender affirming care, you would think it would be the same thing, and in most places it is, but some of these attempts to politicize this are going against that usual framework. And then same for growth hormone that you mentioned. That's a decision that's internal to a family, parents and their children, and with the counsel of their physicians, so a patient-physician decision. That's why it's so surprising that there is this attempt to separate out gender-affirming care from that usual model.
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Dr. Safer, you mentioned the politicization of this issue. Florida's health department just issued guidance against gender-affirming care to doctors in that state and accused federal guidance, including the CDC and national healthcare groups like the American Academy of Pediatrics, for saying they were politicizing it by their endorsement of these procedures. You've written and tweeted in the opposite direction that these bans are unnecessarily politicizing. How do you weigh the political back and forth on this?
Well, within medicine, there is no political back and forth. that is the Endocrine Society, which is the 18,000 person organization of endocrinologists internationally, based in Washington, D.C., or bigger yet, the American College of Physicians, or bigger yet, the AMA, are all on the same page on this subject, which is, we're data-driven. We do experiments to see what's best. We follow the data and we make the judgments with regard to what's best in terms of medical care across the entire spectrum of medical care. gender-affirming care fits in that framework. And so there, unless you want to view all of medicine, all of organized medicine as being on some side of a political argument, then there is no political argument. And like you've heard me say, it's a mystery to me. That is, medical people do not all share the same politics. If you want to go to a meeting of the AMA or of the Endocrine Society and discuss some of the other issues that we debate in society, you will find people who are Republicans and people who are Democrats and people who are conservative and people who are liberal and so on. But we won't debate that we use science to inform us for our treatment decisions. And that is true for gender affirming care also.
We're talking to Dr. Joshua Safer, Executive Director of the Mount Sinai Center for Transgender Medicine and Surgery in New York, looking at gender affirming care for teens in particular, as states around the country pass or attempt to pass laws against that kind of care. We had a comment through our Wisconsin project. Our writer says, I do not have trans kids. I am the trans person in my family. They go on, at 61, I have yet to receive any more than hormones, though I've pushed for more extensive options with Medicaid. My health care has been interrupted by transphobic providers. My peers have gotten the services I desire long ago, and I feel left behind and regarded as worthless. So our listener looks back on a life of not having received that care. Not an uncommon story, I'm guessing, Dr. Safer.
Yeah, I'm sorry to hear that story, but you are right. It is it used to be even a more common story because we weren't providing the care that we needed to be providing. There's been a shift in the establishment medical world in terms of our understanding of gender identity as a biological phenomenon, as for all intents and purposes, part of biological sex, and that has resulted in a shift in our entire approach to care, where we have been able to do better by our patients than we had in the past.
There are probably people listening and people participating in this debate who don't believe that's a thing, that there are only men and there are women, and they don't acknowledge a category aside from that, in between it, wherever on the map. What would you say to them in particular?
Well, our understanding of the complexity of sex or biological sex, and I'm using those words to mean all of that biology that is part of reproduction, our understanding of that complexity has evolved over the years. So once upon a time, we thought it related just to body parts, to anatomy. Then we understood more. We understood chromosomes. We understood genes. And right now in 2022, the model probably has about six categories of components that in order to have reproduction, you know what sex you are, you know your choice of partners, you have certain body parts, you have certain gametes, cells, that is sperm or eggs that can mix for that reproduction. And for most of the population, those are all aligned in a certain way. But we know that each of those pieces is coded by different genes, and people can have some of those genes not aligned with others. We can see it physically in some people. And with regard to gender identity, we couldn't see it, which is why we're late in discovering it. But we certainly can ascertain that to be true. And that's all transgender people are, as a person with that particular circumstance.
Time for one more caller. Stella is with us in Sturgeon Bay. Stella, hello.
Hi. I've been very distressed ever since this news came out from the governor of Texas. It seems to me that given the emotional and mental distress that it causes, that it will cause children and adolescents, transgender children and adolescents, if they are denied the medical treatment that they need in order to be at home in their own bodies and their own identity, it seems to me that the governor and any other politicians who propose and who put forward and who pass this kind of legislation that would deny these children and prosecute their parents It seems to me that the child abusers are the governor of Texas and the politicians who put forth and passed this kind of legislation.
Stella, thanks for the call. Just a minute or so left. Dr. Safer, can you talk about the impact on these kids, these adolescents that Stella is worried about?
Well, I share her fear. I share Stella's fear. And I only wish that these politicians that would look to the medical community to inform them in medical care. Texas has great medical institutions, Baylor, University of Texas, Florida, the same. It's not like they need to go to other states even to find experts in care who could help them inform their decisions and make them medical and science-based.
Dr. Safer, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
That's Dr. Joshua Safer, Executive Director of the Mount Sinai Center for Transgender Medicine and Surgery in New York. He's also senior faculty at the ICANN School of Medicine at Mount Sinai. He talked to us today about bills in states around the country, including some here in Wisconsin, that are aimed at banning medical treatments for transgender youth.